Welcome to This Is Money Show, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Here alongside Simon and I is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And on the agenda today, magic money trees and epic Greek-style collapses. Not new children's stories for an austerity era. We're actually talking about the public sector pay cap, back on the political agenda with gusto. But can the country afford a multi-billion pound wage increase for our teachers and nurses? And could it be done without tax hikes? Also, we celebrate or commiserate 10 years without a single rate rise from the Bank of England. Is one imminent? If so, what can you do to protect yourself? We also look at the impact of rising student fees, explore another north-south divide, and have some top tips on getting your dream house for a dream price. All that and plenty more coming up, and don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the row over the public sector pay gap turned up a significant notch this week after a number of cabinet ministers came out in favour of scrapping it. The tough austerity measure was placed on 5 million workers, including teachers, nurses and soldiers, back in 2012 when their pay was capped at just 1%. Now that was preceded by a two-year freeze for all but the lowest earners. It meant many are thousands of pounds worse off a year as a result, not helped, of course, by the rising cost of living.
Last week, the Chancellor said, "We all value our public services and the people who provide them to us," and went on to laud his own economic record by saying that we had a fundamentally robust economy. Well, the Prime Minister found £1 billion to keep her own job. Why can't she find the same amount of money to keep nurses and teachers in their job, who, after all, serve all of us?
The Tories went into the election pledging to keep the cap until 2020, but given the bruising they got at the polls, many within the party are calling for a rethink. Now, if it was scrapped, the Chancellor would have to have an almighty root around the back of the sofa and find upwards of £5 billion to raise the cap. And there's a deficit, of course, to get rid of. We're set to borrow a further £50 billion just this year. But there's no magic money tree, says Theresa May, who raised the spectre this week of a Greek-style economic collapse.
I understand that it has been hard for people who've been working hard and making sacrifices over the years as we've been dealing with Labour's mismanagement of the economy. Let me remind the Right Honourable Gentleman of what happens when you don't deal with the deficit. It's not a theoretical issue. Let's look at those countries that failed to deal with it. In Greece, where they haven't dealt with the deficit, yes. What did we see with failure to deal with the deficit? Spending on the health service cut by 36%. We are doing what is important for this country, which is ensuring there are jobs and an economy providing those jobs for people, because the best route out of poverty is being in work.
So can we afford to give 5 million people a pay rise? Will we have to pay more in tax? Or could paying public sector workers more even be a boost for the economy? A very warm welcome, Lee. A very warm welcome, Simon.
Morning.
All right then, Simon, to you first, if that's all right. The election was a month ago. We've had this cap in place for years. Why on earth are we going on about it so much now?
Was it really only a month ago? Feels like a lot longer than that, doesn't it? To me, it feels like we've been having this election for years. So why has this come up now? Well, it's come up because all sorts of things are coming out of the woodwork now. The vote for Jeremy Corbyn and his Labour Party, which it should be noted still involved them losing the election, not winning it, as some people seem to believe they did. But the vote has been taken as a vote against austerity. Basically, people have had enough of austerity. And so you've got all kinds of things to do with austerity coming out of the woodwork as part of this supposed rejection of it. And one of these things is the public sector pay cap. I actually think that this is something that cuts right across the political sort of divide, right across society, and is actually something that quite a lot of people don't really think is necessarily right. So public sector pay rises were capped at 1%. Now, if inflation's below 1%, that's fine. It means people's wages are going up in real terms. But whilst it was below 1% for a period of time, it's now well above 1%. So basically, all of those people in the public sector are getting a pay cut every year. So this is not a pay rise. We're not really talking about a 1% pay rise. At the moment, we're talking about a 2% pay cut. And if you suddenly turn the language around and started talking about it in those ways, maybe you might find some other people change their mind on the subject. But it's a really sore point for people who work in the public sector. And it goes back to this argument between the public sector and the private sector, each of which thinks that the other side is doing much, much better than it, and that the grass is so much greener on the other side. So the public sector thinks everybody in the private sector is basically in clover. Like, literally, they go to sleep on a bed of money every night, and it's absolutely wonderful. And everybody in the private sector thinks that the people in the public sector are massively overpaid for what they do, and they just sit on their hands all day doing no work, and at the end of it they get a massive pension that they don't have to pay any money into. Now, you won't be surprised to learn that neither of those things are actually true. And actually, in the public sector, wages on average are higher than they are in the private sector. So a bit of myth-busting there. And in the public sector, wages did actually continue to rise after the financial crisis for a couple of years, when wages were falling on occasion in the private sector, or many companies imposed a pay freeze. Also, in the public sector, you do have probably better employment rights than people in the private sector. It is generally harder to get sacked from the public sector. You generally get better benefits. You're more likely to get something like flexible working. You're more likely to get something like flexi time. But on the other hand, there are an awful lot of people in the public sector who've been pushed into being contractors by the public sector. And there's a whole extra row about that. And it's much harder to get ahead in the public sector because of pay grades. And if you go and work in a local authority, for example, everybody sticks very stringently to the bandings, and you have to slowly move your way up the bandings. And it's only the people at the top who are making the big, big bucks who get to be more flexible. Whereas in the private sector, if you work for a company, they can promote you in any way they want, really. Some big companies strictly impose these bandings, but it's quite easy to very rapidly go up the ladder in the private sector. So it's quite easy to suddenly earn a lot more money. But what this comes down to is that this 1% cap on public sector pay increases has now been in place for 5 years. It was part of the austerity measures. And to be perfectly honest, I have an awful lot of sympathy with people who say enough is enough. If in the aftermath of a financial crisis, in the aftermath of a recession, if a company wants to have a pay freeze, if a company wants to say to its workers, we'll try and keep you employed, but we might need to cut your wages, if a company wants to put a cap on it, that's fine in the short term. But in the medium to long term, you need to be paying people a fair wage, and their wage needs to be going up with the cost of living. Otherwise, they're taking a pay cut. And I think 5 years of telling people to take a pay cut is too long.
All right, I'll get Lee's views. Just a point, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, talking about the public and private sector row, as it were, they've both seen pay fall by around 5% since the financial crash. So no one's in clover. I've never heard that expression before, by the way. I rather like it. I'm going to steal that. But the question is, I don't think anyone in this room thinks that the people who look after us shouldn't get a pay rise, but how are we going to afford it? Where's the money going to come from? Every percentage point by which the public sector pay is lifted will cost the Exchequer around £2 billion. So with inflation closing in at 3%, public sector workers would need a pay lift of around this amount just to stand still. So these costs are not small. And then, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, we've got Theresa May talking about getting rid of the deficit, borrowing £50 billion more this year. Lee, it's a big back of the sofa we're going to have to dig right down.
It is, Georgian. Do you know, it's a very difficult balancing act, isn't it, to make everyone happy. And at the end of the day, things like our police force, for example, they've had massive cuts, you know, for actual levels of people that are working in the police force now. So things like that, it's quite galling, isn't it, for people to think, well, you know, the starting wages are standing still from what they were, you know, 5-7 years ago. And, you know, when does the point come when enough is enough? You know, nurses are stretched. You know, teachers are working far harder than they probably had to do in the past because some of these schools now are getting quite unruly. You know, it's a much more difficult job.
So you think about the job they do, and you've had the awful tragedies, haven't you, of terrorism, of Grenfell Tower.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, you have to doff your cap to them because it's, you know, it's hard work. It is hard work. And, you know, to be quite honest with you, I'm probably not alone in thinking that these people do deserve at least an inflation, you know, rising wage. But it's a tough balance act, isn't it? But then, you know, the government's getting criticised for finding £1 billion down the back of the sofa to do the deal with the DUP. So what else is down that back of that sofa?
Yeah, and absolutely.
The guy from the Fiscal Institute for Fiscal Studies gave some good comments to Rachel Paul Johnson, you know, saying actually there is money to do it. But it's just all about priorities. Mm. And again, I'll go back. It's such a balancing act, isn't it? You know, if you start raising taxes, people in the private sector get upset, you know, saying that there's lots of fat still to trim in the public sector. And this argument goes back and forth. And I think actually to see how polarised this is, we had a poll on the story, in the story that Rachel had written, saying, would you be happy for your taxes to rise in order to give nurses a pay boost? Mm. Actually, really interestingly, it was so divided. A third said yes, a third said no, and a third said, I already pay enough to do it. So it's a very polarised topic. I've had a look through the reader comments in this. You know, some people make really good arguments as to why wages should go up. People make good arguments as to why they shouldn't go up. So it's a really difficult balancing act.
It's interesting, we heard Jeremy Corbyn talking about priorities. Exactly that, the DUP. Theresa May can find £1 billion to save her own job. How about finding that sort of money to help the jobs of other people? But we did talk about trust, didn't we, in a previous episode about tax. And I think a lot of that, when you ask people how much more that they would want to pay in tax, mm-hmm. a lot of it might come down to trust. If we trusted where it was going more, would we be willing to pay more? Do listen back to previous episodes if you want to know about that. But I guess it's more about economics 101. There is also this argument that if you pay people more, well, it could actually be a boost to the economy, mm-hmm. couldn't it? They'll go out and they'll spend some more. What mm-hmm. do you think to that?
So that's it's called the fiscal multiplier. So basically,
it's always got a good name, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's always. And it's a good explainer here. So, you know, if a family had an extra £30 a week in their pay packet, they might spend some of it on debts and paying off debts and that sort of stuff, but they're just as likely to spend it in the supermarket and cinema, you know, petrol, that sort of thing. And then in a roundabout way, some of that goes back to the government in the form of VAT or income tax, corporation tax. So that sort of thing is kind of like a circle. And if you keep building it up and people get more pay, and it's just a sort of like, it's a positive cycle for the economy. So that's, it's a really good explainer actually in Rachel's article, it very in-depth. Explainer. It's well worth a read.
So why aren't we doing that, Simon?
Well, because we've got our priorities fixed, haven't we? And that's the problem with the way these things work out. And that's why you have to be very careful about doing things like imposing a 5-year or longer cap on public sector pay, because all of a sudden you start discovering people start talking about priorities and saying that we no longer make paying people who work in our public sector and look after us in our day-to-day lives. Essentially, you know, they work in the public service. We no longer consider giving them pay that increases with the cost of living to be a priority. And that sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? I mean, of course paying people who work for us a fair wage is a priority. But somehow we managed to remove that, not just in the short term, but now into the medium term, from our national spending. And now we're talking about the fact that we can't afford to make it a priority again. But then if you look on the other side of the coin, something that we have made a priority and has just recently been reinforced as a priority is paying the triple lock. So pensioners are basically getting their annual payments increased by the minimum of wages, inflation, or 2.5%. So whilst we've imposed a 1% pay cap on the public sector, we have imposed at least a 2.5% pay rise on pensioners. And that's been decided that's a priority. So I think it comes down to something we talked about in the run-up to the election and to do with that whole question around tax and whether we're willing to pay more of it or whether we just need to be a lot more confident that it's going to the right places, is we need to have a bit more of a national discussion about these priorities. But at the moment, and if you look back probably over at least the last decade, I think we struggle to do that because basically it always descends into Punch and Judy politics. And whilst I don't think that comparisons with Greece are particularly sensible from the Prime Minister, because there is a very big difference between the UK economy and the Greek economy.
Didn't George Osborne do the same, though, in 2010 when he did the same argument?
Yeah, but I also don't think that Jeremy Corbyn's you can find £1 billion to pay to Northern Ireland to do this deal kind of thing. I don't think that kind of argument helps either. It's just knockabout politics and nobody's actually talking about the topic at the heart of the matter. And if people could be talking about this in the way, you know, Lee just referred to the explanation from Paul Johnson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. If people could be talking about it in the way that those people are talking about it, which is perfectly sensible. It's like, well, we've got this thing, we've got that thing, we've got a limited amount of money. Here's what we need to do about it. Then we can have a proper discussion about it. But there is an element, you know, to go back to your question of if you pay people £1 more, you collect about 30p of it back in tax straight away in the form of national insurance and income tax. Any money they spend, you get 20% off on VAT. Some of it's going to go on petrol, and you get an unbelievable amount of that back in tax. Some of it might even go on booze and fags, and you get tons of that back too. I mean, if someone buys a flight, there's the air passenger duty. We could go on and on and on, listing all the things that people will get taxed on for spending it. And also, if people spend money, it goes into the economy, it goes to companies and creates the environment where people can make productive use of things. And I think that you don't have to be a full-on dyed-in-the-wool Keynesian to realise that basically if people are really, really struggling and you let them earn a little bit more money, and we're not talking about a huge amount of money here, then actually that might be good for the economy if you happen to live in an economy that at the moment has a problem with low wages, which is what ours does.
Yes, indeed. We'll move on from that, but inflation up, wages up by a paltry amount. Blood pressure of Theresa May, possibly, also up. One thing that's not gone north, though, is interest rates. Yes, it's been exactly 10 years, and 8 million of us have never witnessed a rise from the Bank of England in our adult lives. I say us there, I was obviously an adult when it was last raised. Borrowers celebrating savers ruining a decade, though, of battling low rates. Those with cash in the bank have seen their interest they get wither away to virtually nothing. Does this explain record low savings rates, though, that we're seeing? Can the country cope with a rise, especially when it comes to our mortgages? And what about investing? Are more of us dipping our toe in? If not, what's holding us back? Could robo-advisors be the answer? But first, wow, 10 years. Lee. Did you see that one coming?
Yeah. No, if you asked me 10 years ago, perhaps not, Georgia. I would never have guessed.
How old were you 10 years ago?
I would have been 20. So I have seen a rise in my adult life. But yeah, 10 years, no rate rise. We've obviously had one little dip. Yeah, doesn't time fly?
Doesn't it just when you're having fun, spending money and borrowing it? But mood has changed. Oh, we say this all the time. I don't want you to look in the crystal ball. I'm bored of that game. It's 10 years now. We've had enough of this. But what I really want to know, Luke, from you, from everything you're hearing, if it does go up, and it's not going to go up great guns, as I think Simon's already put later that in the last episode, but 8 million of us have never known anything other than low rates. They're so used to the fact that they're paying these low rates. Are we going to cope? I mean, I'm looking at figures like 16 million people have less than £100 in savings. How are we going to manage this? What are the monetary terms of it? You know, if your mortgage goes up by 1%, you're talking hundreds of pounds extra people are going to have to pay.
Exactly, yeah. And I think actually the advice is not to let your guard down, because if rates do go up and you start seeing your mortgage rate going higher, then there's going to be lots of people that are going to be struggling. And, you know, you can't see base rate going up very high. When it does go up, it's going to be, I reckon, quite slowly in the next couple of years if it eventually does. But it's a real...
There are stricter lending checks.
There's stricter lending checks. And the report that was out last week showed just how few people now have 100% mortgages, for example. You know, most people do have a 10, 15% deposit when they first buy a house and that sort of thing. But I think actually, we're talking about not having money in the bank and savings rates are so low, people have just been put off from saving because they're just thinking, well, I'm not going to earn anything off this money. But getting in the habit, building up that buffer and having some cash in the bank, even if you are earning 1%, at least you've got a safety net if things go south.
Lee, I want to ask you about this because we did get figures out this week, didn't we? From the ONS, and it's all about savings ratios.
Yes.
Basically, how much of our income we're stashing away into savings. And it's really not looking pretty. In fact, it's the smallest since the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it's dropped sharply, I understand, in the last year alone. Mm-hmm. But you've talked there about something that's really kind of gets me a little bit. And I mentioned there, 16 million people have less than £100 in savings. Mm-hmm. And you hear the argument time and time again that it's low rates. Mm-hmm. But I have to ask the question, if you are someone who is struggling at all to save, are you honestly going to care that a cash ISA rate, for example, is 1.1% and there might be a better one for 1.2%? Honestly, these people don't have the money. The interest rate argument on savings accounts doesn't hold water with everybody, certainly a lot of people.
I would totally say that's a valid point, Georgie. A lot of people don't have money at the end of the month to put away into a piggy bank, you know, and that's just a fact of life, isn't it? And you're right, a lot of people, especially at the moment, looking at interest rates, it probably doesn't really factor much into their decision of when they can save. You know, as you say, there's millions of people, and for one reason or another, don't have any savings at all. And you've got to look at a place like Germany, for example. They save like mad out there. You know, is it that we waste money on things that we don't particularly need? You know, are there things that you could cut back on? Even if you started saving £5-10 a month, just to start in the habit, is what I would say to someone in that argument. Okay, maybe that's a simplistic view. Maybe a lot of people can't do that. But I still think there's a lot of waste. I still think there are households that waste a lot of money on things that could easily be chopped. And all you've got to do is sit down, have a look for your finances, get a spreadsheet, see what ins and outs are going. No, no, it sounds boring. No, I know you're laughing.
All you've got to do is, you know, I'm agreeing with you there.
There are things that, you know, if you're not saving 20 quid, you can't afford to save 20 quid a month. I think you've got to be looking at yourself saying, well, there's got to be somewhere you can cut back. Again, I know that's not going to work for everyone, but I really do think that people could get in the savings habit if they really wanted to. It's not helping at the moment, the fact that there's nothing out there that's really captivating people. I'd written a column this week about the NSNI 2.2% bond that was launched by Philip Hammond, which is completely missed the mark. You know, it doesn't beat inflation. It could have done better by setting up a product that's linked to inflation or gets under 25 saving or gets households. There was once upon a time, about a year ago, there was when David Cameron was still Prime Minister, they were talking about savings accounts for people that couldn't save, and there was going to be some big incentive. I mean, God knows where that's gone now after everything that's happened in the last year. I mean, I'm pretty certain that's not going to be on the top of the agenda. But, you know, getting in the habit, Georgie, honestly, I've said the word habit about 20 times, but it is important.
It was what Paul Johnson said about priorities. I had a chat with someone the other day who said they spend £1,000 on childcare, so they haven't got any money to save at all.
It's crazy amount of money, isn't it?
It is crazy. But I said, imagine if it was £1,025 every month for childcare. Would you pay that? And she went, yeah, of course I would.
You just have to pay.
Well, why don't you just view that £25 as like another national insurance? Yeah. This one you get back. But Simon, what do you think is the issue? What is the reason for this? The lowest since the 1960s, particularly dropping in the last year. Can you put that down to anything tangible, any one thing?
Well, firstly, if you look at the way people's behaviour works, people will do things if you give them an incentive. And the idea of earning interest on your savings is an incentive. So if you are earning practically no interest on your savings, then there is practically no incentive to do so. However, you're right in saying that when you start to save, the interest that you earn on your money is basically negligible. Literally, even if interest rates were at 10%, the interest that you're earning on your money really isn't very much when you're starting out saving. What really makes a difference is your contributions and you doing it regularly and you putting the money in. So let's take, for example, the people who don't even have £100 in savings. Okay. And actually, they're not really the prime target. The people who don't even have £100 in savings, unless they are basically people who are just spending rather than saving, they aren't really the prime target. The people who don't have £100 are probably struggling to make ends meet, and they're in a negative number every month. So there's very little you can actually do in that scenario to save money. But if you're in that bunch of people, and actually you probably could save a bit of money somewhere, then even if you could only save £10 a month, and you did that for a whole year, you'd have £120. And it's the cumulative effect of you saving £10 a month that's going to get you the money. The interest on that would be hardly anything. So you miss a couple of months, you have £100. You have £200 in savings rather than £100. So you have twice as much. And if you just keep doing that, it'll build up. But if you take that up the scale, you know, not to make... It's dangerous making sweeping generalisations, OK? But I hear lots of comments from people, they can't afford to save, they don't have any spare money, their rent is so high, all these other things. Yet a lot of them are walking around with iPhone 7s in their hand. They've got Netflix accounts, you know, various other things. And it's like, well, you've got to, you know, you don't need that phone, okay? An iPhone 5 is a perfectly good phone, okay? You just get the phone, like, and so see out the contract and then keep the phone and go on to a SIM-only deal and save yourself £30 a month and put £30 a month into your savings account. The Netflix account. If you're saying you don't have any money, you don't have any money to save, stop spending £8 a month on Netflix. And this sounds like the kind of really annoying older person who's got enough money to save and everything like that and owns their own home and everything that young people complain about all the time. But just because it sounds really annoying, okay, does not mean that there is not a grain of truth in it. Mm. And I think that the problem is we've lost the savings culture and we have developed a gimme stuff culture. And as long as it only costs me X amount of money per month, I'll be fine culture. And people don't think about the other things they could be doing with that money. And because there isn't the incentive, because there isn't the culture of saying to people, just build this money up over time. Yes, in the first 2 years, you're literally going to look at this and go, why am I even bothering saving that money? But after 3, 4, 5 years, you're going to think, oh, yeah, I'm doing all right here. Your wages will go up. You save a bit more money, save some of every pay rise you get. If you're lucky enough to have a mortgage that you can move on to a cheaper mortgage rate, which there are tons of people who could do that and haven't actually done it, move your mortgage onto the cheaper rate, and then the money that you were spending every month on your higher rate mortgage, save it. Or just save half of it, even. You don't even have to save all of it. Spend half on yourself. It's various things like that. But I do think that, like you say, Georgie, it's like, how do you get... How do you turn that oil tanker around? And it is literally like turning an oil tanker around, because the entire modern world is built on credit and easy money and not saving up for stuff that you want. You only have to look at all of the problems and all the stuff that's being talked about in the car industry at the moment with finance there to know about it.
I agree with you. I hate sweeping generalisations as well. I do largely agree with your argument. But and Lee, I'm going to ask you about this, because there's been a lot made this week about student fees and how the fact that students are going to be leaving university with £57,000 of debt, you're hearing. How do you say to those people leaving university now, and by all accounts, people from the lowest earning backgrounds are the ones who are going to be hit the hardest and most of those won't be paid off. But how do you say to those people, put aside £10 a month, get into the savings culture. What for? What for?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because actually what we're encouraging our young adults to do when they go to university is basically to stack up a huge amount of debt, which immediately makes them sort of panic. Mm. But then a lot of people just see it as a number.
Then come out of university and buy a house and get more debt.
Sorry, just to cut in there. We're not only doing that, but when they take out that huge amount of debt, the entire machine says to them, don't worry about the huge amount of debt. You might never pay it all back.
Yes, exactly.
No, it's very true. And then you start to think, well, yeah, how do you encourage someone like that that's gone off straight off the bat with a massive amount of debt to then start putting £10 a month away, because they're thinking, well, I mean, that's not even... It's going to touch the size of this debt that's mounting up. But, you know, I think if you're a university student, you've just... With these tuition fees now, which are absolutely scandalous, they're scandalously high, and, you know, to give people... you know, an education that they need to keep Britain as one of the top countries in the world for our academic minds, it's very hard to then go, well, you need to start saving. But it's a frightful amount of debt, Georgia. I can't even imagine the billions that must be just sitting there in student loans accounts just that will never get paid off. That's the thing, it's such a large proportion of it won't get paid off.
When people say doesn't get paid off, someone's going to have to pay for it, or are they just pointless? Do we not need the money?
I mean, the taxpayer will end up eventually picking up the debt in 30 years' time. But brilliantly, though, you introduce a system like this and you structure it in such a way that basically lots of people might never actually earn enough money to pay off the debt. And you use it as a way of saving money on the university system. Of course, not accounting for the fact that in 3 decades' time, the country's going to start having to pick up the tab for that, just as it's picking up the tab for a whole load more pensioners, whilst there's much less people working and everything else. But I think the current student fees system is absolutely hideous, because it's not just the fees, it's then the living costs as well. You borrow the money for that. Coming out of university with 50 grand's worth of debt is terrible. And actually, there was a study I read the other day that said, amazingly, our students are coming out of debt, are coming out of university with the most debt in the Western world, even more than in the States. Now, and that's because even though we think of in the States them having very, very high, you know, university tuition fees, that's almost something that the government decided we'd head down the route of. Apparently, there's a lot more variance in it.
So there's actually the
average student comes out with less debt. And I think what really worries me about the current fee system, though, is that somehow in a really short space of time, it's managed to completely ingrain the idea of the fees into our heads, so that the idea of scrapping them was considered completely wild. You know, absolutely wild.
What's like, annoyed me on Corbyn's Twitter?
Corbyn's gone completely bananas. He's going to scrap tuition fees. Well, we haven't had them for that long. I was in the
well,
first
exactly
year of university
me
to
that
have
those
them.
Arguing to keep them.
I was the first year of university to have them, and I'm not that old. You know, yeah. I'm 38 years old, and they were £1,000 a year when I started. Then they went up to £3,000, and £3,000 a year was really controversial. And then all of a sudden, we sent them up to £9,000. And now, even if Corbyn had come out and said, I'm going to cut them back to £3,000, it would have been considered massively controversial. Yet that's only where they were. And also, there is this huge issue. I mean, and the university's pushed back on this a lot, but people don't really think they're getting particularly good value for money for this, okay? I've been out of university for a good amount of time, so maybe it's changed a lot since I was there, but, you know, I did English and philosophy, and I was doing 8-9 hours a week. And I was told by one of the tutors, because he said to me, I don't understand how this works. Like, when you're in the class, it's great. You answer the questions, you talk about things, you seem to be knowledgeable and all these other things. Then you hand me in an essay, and it's kind of all over the show. And I was like, that's because I basically write one essay a term. per topic that I'm studying, and this term I'm studying three, so I'm writing three essays a term. I said when I was at school, I was writing three essays a week, and I was great at knocking them out. And he said, and I said to him, like, why do we not spend more time with the tutors? Why don't we spend more time being taught? What is this whole thing about? I spend the vast majority of my week just sat by myself, you know, doing whatever. Not work.
Yeah, not work. Okay. You're not reading.
Yeah.
I would like to point out your essays are a lot better now, though, by the way.
I should have gone to journalism college first, actually. That's the thing that knocks it into you. But he said that the universities are a victim of their own success. You know, so this is in the early 2000s, the turn of the millennium. He said, go back 10, 20 years, we did spend time with people. It was more like the kind of Oxford, Cambridge, collegiate kind of thing. But nowadays, basically, unless you're doing like a science or an engineering or something like that kind of course, we just basically can't spend time with the students. We've got too many students, not enough staff. And then there's all this pressure on the universities to be doing research. So they used to be very much graded on the research that they do, the postgraduate stuff that they do. And none of that involves teaching the mugs who are paying £9,000 a year.
I've got to say, I mean, I think that there's a lot of university courses that could easily be 2 years, maybe even 1 year, rather than 3 years. I think they need to be shortened a bit. And I remember...
I did 4 hours a week.
This is what I mean. And I remember I was the last year, actually, that it was £1,000 tuition fees. It went up to £3,000 when I went into my second year, which obviously I wasn't affected by. But I remember at the end of year, the start of my second year, the tutor saying, we've had an absolute flood of students coming in this year because tuition fees have gone up. The uni's gone on a massive drive because they're going to make a load of money out of it. And we're letting in people that haven't really got the A-levels results that we would have let in the past. And I remember being really flabbergasted by that. Just literally added like 2,000 extra students on because the fees were going up so much. And they were just letting sort of like anyone in. And I was like, oh, great. Well, this hasn't devalued my degree in the slightest, does it?
I mean, I think it's worth offering the defence of this system, okay, which gets put forward, which is that that over the past, you know, 15, 20 years, we've seen a much greater number of people from lower income families going to university and getting a degree. That's the defence that's mounted of this, that the fee system has done this, that you know, it's shifted things away from the wealthier to the lower end. Although actually that has changed now because they've axed the maintenance grants. So actually it started to shift back towards benefiting the wealthy.
And the research and, showing that they're the ones leaving with the most amount of debt.
But I think that the problem is that whilst it's all very well saying, well, we've got lots more people on lower incomes coming out of university with a degree, it's like, but what is the quality of the degree that they're coming out of university with? And I think there's a great deal of questioning around whether we've built a higher education system that is basically producing education as a social good, and meaning that we've got a workforce and a nation that is that much better trained, that much better educated, that much more able to deal with the challenges that the world throws at it, or whether we've got a lot of people who've basically just ticked a box.
Wasn't it Tony Blair, though, who said he wanted to get it up to 50% of people going to university back in the day? Now, people talk about the quality of degrees, but I suppose what worries me is people going to university. I did history. Would I go and do it again now? No, I don't think I would. I worry about things like creative arts and history and those sorts of degrees where everybody's doing tech or economics or something financial related, she says on a financial podcast.
I think that the current university system, if we're talking about, you know, the system where there's a huge number of people not doing an awful lot of hours a week being taught by people, actually would be much better suited to people going when they were in their late 20s or 30. And then they've got the maturity and possibly the hunger to deal with that scenario and try and work hard to improve themselves and know that in the 30 hours a week, the 30 hours out of the standard 37-hour working week that nobody's actually teaching them, that they need to knuckle down and do some reading and be in the library and networking and talking to other people and coming up with bright ideas and stuff like that. Whereas I just don't think that your average 18-year-old is equipped to do that. I mean, I think everybody should probably not go straight to university from school. Mm. They should probably go do some work first, because at least it drums a little bit of the world into them. But I don't think even someone who's 19 who's done that is ready for that. I think that the current system, unless you do something like a science or an engineering degree, and, you know, it'd be great if we had more people doing those, I think it's far better suited to people who are in their late 20s or their early 30s who will actually appreciate it and work that bit harder at it and be much better equipped to deal with working by themselves than some kid who's just come out of school.
Mm. All right, Lee, I'm going to ask you a question related to, I suppose, students, because it's not just about the tuition fees, you know, housing as well, but it's not just students. We're talking about renting. And on your website, you've been taking a look over the last decade, a clear north-south divide emerging here as well, not just with house prices, but with renting. And I thought, Lee, the gap was narrowing.
No, it's not. This research shows basically that rents in London are really sort of pushed up over the last decade, whereas areas like the northeast, the northwest, they've actually dropped since 2007, which is, it's quite unbelievable when you think about it.
I mean, so if you're going to uni, that might be something to worth consider.
Yeah, well, this is it. There's a huge divide between going to university in London, going to university in the southeast, and going to university in the north, because accommodation costs are one area of university sort of goes that you don't really think about it. And I studied in London, and even back then it was 100 and something quid a week, you know, which is a lot of money. You know, it was pushing £500 a month to stay in a pretty rubbish place. But you know, as the article points out, and a lot of our readers point out, the thing is, London has got such a strong rental market because so many people have been priced out, actually being able to buy. The fluidity of the jobs, you know, there's just so many jobs in London. That's the thing, isn't it? A lot of people want to live. It's such a vibrant city. So, you know, for that reason, rents have been increasing.
We got plans in the Queen's Speech, didn't we, to bring forward a ban on unfair letting agents' fees. I'm wondering if you think that's going to help renters or actually make the situation worse. They're going to pass the costs on and we're going to see rent rises.
It's been a funny couple of years for buy to let. I feel like that landlords really have been sort of pummeled with all sorts of measures. But anything that makes that whole process for a tenant renting a property, because let's face it, there's a lot of things. Actually, I've been a renter in the past, and some things that happen are just, some landlords are way better than others. And we were talking about sweeping generalisations, so I'm not going to start making sweeping generalisations. But, you know, some landlords can be particularly, you know, spiky people, you know, when it comes to getting your deposit back, when
I've
it comes to paying,
you know, all of that
sort of stuff. Anything that can improve that whole system, you know, having to pay a letting agent some fee for signing a bit of paper that they've printed off, you know, charging some ridiculous like 100 quid for some letter that they printed off and then they've signed. And, you know, it's that sort of thing that actually, when you're in London and it's already costing on average, you know, 1600 quid a month to rent, it's just even more galling, isn't it, when you have to deal with all of those sort of problems. At the end of the day, everyone wants somewhere to live for a reasonable price, and they're comfortable. But unfortunately, we are in a world, especially in London, it's just rife where rent's out of control.
It's completely flipped as well on its head, hasn't it? In the past, you'd rent to save money to buy a house.
Yeah.
Long gone are those
days.
It's
so tough. I mean, when you're, especially for couples, I think, because if you're a couple, you're not in a house yet and you want to live just like you two, sort of studio flats, one-bedroom flats are so sort of sought after. That's an area of the market that really does push up, and you end up in this little pokey flat. I'm saying 1500 quid a month, and this was a couple of years ago. I think it's probably close to £2,000 to live that sort of lifestyle now. And you're right. I mean, that is probably half your wages at least going on renting. And then you've got your transport costs, you know, factoring that in. It's a big whack. So it's getting harder and harder for people to save. And in the meantime, although there's been a few bits of data out in recent months saying that annual house price growth is slowing slightly, it's gone up and up and up over the years. And trying to save for a deposit, as your rent's gone up, it almost keeps on adding more time as you're trying to save up for a deposit. And it's become a difficult game to play.
I do want to ask you, though, Lee, if you are on the property ladder or perhaps you want to move on, how do you get the best possible price? Because you've been looking at that on your website, but your moment hath arrived because Lee, with a little boy who dreamed of being an estate agent, I kid you not, you've got some tips for us. Things like how much should you offer? How hard should you negotiate? And is it ever worth paying over the asking price?
Well, it all depends, doesn't it? And a lot of this is about the type of property. Some properties are way more sought after than others at the moment, and also the area. It's very localised based, isn't it? So some areas, properties probably are struggling to sell way more than they probably were a couple of years ago or a year ago. Got some data this week about London. 6 in 10 homes that have been withdrawn from the market so far in 2017 have just been withdrawn. They've not been sold. So actually more houses have been withdrawn from the market than have been sold, because people are starting to ask for unrealistic prices. It's even a Simpson in the area I live. I'm looking around at the property market. Some of these homes, I don't know what... I think a lot of it is that people have seen that house prices have been going up the last couple of years. They get sort of they get hoodwinked by the estate agents. If I was an estate agent, Georgia, I feel like I'd be giving them better advice.
You'd be a good one.
I feel like a lot of people are getting ahead of themselves, and estate agents going, well, do you know what? I'll just put it up for this price. You know, they're going to get a little bit more commission off that. And I think a lot of it is unrealistic. I've been bombarded in the last couple of weeks from estate agents, just putting things through the post. People are looking to buy in your area. You know, there's not enough. It's a supply and demand issue. Would you consider us coming around to have a valuation? I'm like, look, if I want my house to be valued and I'm going to put it up for sale, I'm going to approach you. It feels like desperation from estate agents when they're bombarding you, asking you if they can put your house up for sale. So at the end of the day, I always have, if you're looking to buy and you've found a property that you really like, I always think you should go a little bit under the asking price. Not massively, because otherwise you're going to start looking like an idiot. But do your homework. How long has that property been listed for? If it's been listed for a long time, it obviously hasn't sold. Has it had a value decrease? A lot of people go on Rightmove, they go on Zoopla, they know what's happening in the area, they'll have an eye on a property, they'll see that it's been cut in price. Again, that's a sign that it's been overpriced and it's not selling. So you've got a lot of leeway to go in there. If the seller is reducing the price, they obviously want to leave. They've probably found somewhere that they want to buy, so they just now want to get it off their hands, right? So you're in a good position, and you should go in there and you should be firm and you should say, this is what I'm offering. But a lot of people, I think, watch stuff like location, location, location. You see Finn and Kirsty, they start doing these like fake phone calls to the estate agent. Oh yeah, we're going to put in this offer. And a lot of people feel like they can haggle on a property. And it gets a bit confusing. You've got to know what you're doing a little bit.
I haven't seen him this excitable since he went to the Royal Mint, Simon.
Well, I think what you need to do, like Lee said, is you need to do your homework and you need to know about what the person selling needs and wants. Are they a family who wants to move to another home? What they need and what they want is enough money for their home to basically fund the fact that they can move to the next one. And so there'll be a level that you need to get at. If it's a probate sale, for example, it will most likely be a family who the house has been left to. How many people has it been left to? Has it been left to 4 people, 5 people, one person, 2 people? Sometimes if it's like 4 or 5, then they're basically, you'll have 4 or 5 people and you'll have a couple of them go, no, we need to hold out for the highest price. Whereas if it's one person and they're just getting all the money themselves, effectively that's kind of money they've been gifted, money they've inherited. So they might be willing to take a lower price. If it's a probate sale where they just want to get it sold quickly, then you can make a good offer. If a sale has previously dropped through, you need to try and find out what that previous sale was for. Because if you can match that, then you might be able to get the property. If it's a buy-to-let landlord who's selling up, how long have they had it? If they've only had it a couple of years, it's probably going to be a bit harder to negotiate hard on price with them, because they're going to want to be trying to take every little bit of profit that they can do. If they've had it for 10 years, 15 years, then you're probably going to be able to negotiate quite hard with them, as long as you can convince them that you can do the deal fairly quickly, because they're going to have made tons of money on that property. So there's all kinds of things like that. We had this scenario when we bought our flat. The people that we bought off, they'd had the sale fall through. They had somewhere they wanted to buy. They were worried that that was going to fall through. We didn't want to pay what they were asking for. And the estate agent who was acting for them actually ended up negotiating money for them off the house that they were buying by speaking to the other estate agent, which was a probate sale, so that they could then take money off for us. Nice. So that we could then buy the flat. So we ended up getting it at a decent discount. So there's all those things that come into play. So it's, yeah, really do your homework and then think about, what is this home worth to you? What, how long are you going to be there? Because you make money when you buy a property, not necessarily when you sell it. You make it by buying it for the best possible price. And if you can buy it for 5% or 10% less, then that's 5% or 10% more in your pocket, and also a greater buffer in case house prices do fall. General wisdom is you go in 5 to 10% below the asking price. But if you really think something is overpriced, or it's been sat on the market for a long time, or you think somebody is ripe for selling, don't be scared to go in under that. Don't be scared to go in 20% lower, because you can always negotiate up, but it's very difficult to negotiate down.
I was thinking to myself there about the fact that you wanted to be an estate agent. And isn't your mum really, Simon? Isn't your mum really?
Well, no, she's a letting agent.
Yeah, same thing. Same thing. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.